Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
This is John Williams in for Steve Bertrand. Steve's back on Monday. You can normally hear me weekdays from 1 to 3. This week it's noon to 3. Thank you, Steve, for letting me sit in the big chair with Ben Awakenight, your producer. I'm also on Saturday mornings from 10 a.m. till 12 noon. And on social media, I'm WGN King John. So as Ryan just said, at the half, Minnesota is leading Louisville 38-33, that's the 10 over the 7 at the half. And LSU 30, Yale 21, so the 3 seed up by 9 over the 14 seed in the first round. You've got the big Bradley-Michigan State game coming up. It's a big game for Bradley, and I do not want to be in the way of the angry buzzsaw that is going to be Michigan State for the first few rounds. We'll keep you posted on the scores through my show this afternoon. If you're on CNET, you're reading a lot of interesting stories right now, and one of them was written by, in fact, let's just visit with Ben Fox Rubin, who is a senior reporter at CNET. Hey, Ben, it's John Williams, and you're on WGN. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me.
By the way, do you just have anything to say about your brackets? Do you have a team that you're loving? Do you have any insight for us today, sir?
I'm watching a lot of NBA these days. I did not make a bracket because I've had a lot of very bad luck with brackets. I should probably just fill out the next one while closing my eyes. I usually bust my bracket almost immediately.
I think if you don't have a bracket, though, you can't vote. I'm not sure, but I think it's almost...
It's true, yes.
It's so un-American.
I may get jailed, so I shouldn't have said that on live radio.
I'm looking at a whole host of fascinating articles at CNET, and one of them is Deadly Serious, How Facebook and Twitter Rely on You to Stop the Spread of the Mosque Shooting Video. I have been mystified at how, for more than 15 seconds, that man was able to live stream his shooting. What are you all saying about that?
Yeah, so it was several minutes, and the problem that I think a lot of people don't really realize is how big these platforms have become. YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, they get so much user-generated content every single minute of every single day, and it is incredibly difficult for them to really try to effectively moderate against this information that they're basically asking for. They're asking users to bring in this content, and unfortunately, they've created such massive, scalable platforms that it does encourage extremists and mass murderers to live stream these tragedies. It's a pretty awful situation.
I've seen live stream of video of the victims or of people who were being abused by police, and in some ways it was almost constructive, or at least you understood that. In this case, it's the shooter, though, saying, watch this, and off he goes. Was it eyeballs on screens, or is there artificial intelligence that they're using to tell which is which and should something be brought down?
It's both. So Facebook has hired tens of thousands of moderators to actually comb through all the content that goes onto Facebook. Both Facebook and YouTube both have artificial intelligence agents, algorithms that they use to take down all sorts of content, whether it's graphic violence or going against some sort of copyright. Obviously, you're not supposed to go and post an entire movie, so some of these things are a little bit more benign. But ultimately, these efforts aren't doing enough, and we in the tech world end up talking about this a little too often because it has been cropping up a little too much. So they are going to have to figure out a way to fix this problem or do a better job with this problem, because it does seem like an existential threat to these huge social platforms.
Google Stadia, what is that?
So this is a new video game streaming service from Google They just announced it this week, and basically you don't need a really expensive PC anymore to play top-tier, very high-performance games. You could just stream them using Google Stadia, similar to how you might, I don't know, watch something on Netflix. But it's a little bit different because it's a video game as opposed to you just sitting back and watching something.
It's a video game. So what's it like?
I haven't tried it yet, but it's supposedly supposed to really revolutionize the way you play video games. You wouldn't have to have a gaming console at home like a PlayStation 4 or an Xbox One. Or you wouldn't have to spend a lot of money to get a really expensive, chunky PC to play top-tier video games. You would just need an internet connection, and you could play on your browser. So the idea is that it could potentially save you a lot of money. It could make a lot more video games much more easily accessible to more people. But we'll see. I think it's still very early days for this effort.
You get the feeling that the pendulum is still swinging in the direction of video gaming. You know, whenever stories like this come up, people say, gee, I wish kids had less structured play, more outside play, more large muscle play. But it doesn't seem to be halting at all, does it?
Well, yeah. I mean, that I feel gets brought up in every generation. I remember in my generation, they talked a lot about that, too, that, you know, why don't your kids go play outside all the time? I think if parents are really concerned about that, there are obviously a lot more places that people can play video games these days. I mean, mobile gaming is obviously a really easy way to get just biteable games, like you're waiting in line at the supermarket. You could play a video game for about 3 minutes. This is obviously a way that people could potentially play even more video games. So it really depends how much you're a video game fan or don't like video games, whether you would be into this type of service.
We're talking to Ben Fox Rubin. He is a senior reporter at CNET, talking about some of the stories on social media and websites from their site. There's also news. Well, before we get to the Apple announcements, let's just talk a little bit about this strange story of the $12 shoplifting case. What's that all about?
Yeah, so that's a story I spent a couple months on. Basically, facial recognition is this controversial new tool that law enforcement has been using to try to find suspects. And Amazon is one of the vendors that provides this tool to law enforcement. And what's interesting is that they typically promote facial recognition as this effort to solve major crimes like finding missing children or prevent human trafficking. But my investigation actually uncovered that these deputies at the Oregon Sheriff's Office were, in fact, training this tool that's very controversial and very sophisticated to solve very minor crimes, like a $12 shoplifting case or a man trespassing, a man stealing a bicycle. So it was interesting to really see that, in effect, where deputies were actually using this, it was not for nearly as significant incidents as Amazon, at least, was promoting.
Were they doing that just to learn how to do it, or were they just, what was the reason they were spending that much money or energy on a shoplifting case?
So I think learning how to do it is definitely one element there. One of the other elements is that they're legally able to do it.
Yeah,
one could argue either side of it, whether it's an ethical issue, and that's obviously one of the reasons I wrote the story. I think people should know how police are using this tool because it is a new tool. But another reason, as I mentioned, is that there is no legal framework for using facial recognition. Whereas with wiretapping, there are a lot of legal requirements for using wiretapping or using a warrant with facial recognition. It is so new that there are very few laws attached to how you use facial recognition as a law enforcement agency, which allows different law enforcement agencies like the sheriff's office to use it however they see fit. So I definitely think it's an interesting conversation that we should be having.
Very quickly, though, what's the issue? I mean, if they have a mugshot or a picture of you on the street, I guess they have to, what, have permission to use that the way they might to listen in on a phone call? Is that what you're suggesting?
So they do, in fact, use it from a mugshot database. So there are about 300,000 mugshots that they pull from.
But where's the violation then?
There very well may not be a violation. And I've definitely noticed that. The story came out on Monday, and there were a lot of commenters that were saying this is actually a good thing. I think it's important to prevent shoplifting. It doesn't really matter how much somebody is stealing. If a crime has occurred and this makes sheriff's deputies more efficient and more effective in their jobs, then absolutely we're all for it. For me, the important thing was to at least make sure there was transparency in how the tool was actually being utilized, and obviously point out the fact that there was a bit of a discrepancy in how Amazon was promoting this for major crimes when, in fact, that wasn't actually happening. But you're absolutely right that if ultimately people do decide that this is a perfectly reasonable way to use the technology, I think that's certainly very valid. And, you know, my opinion is not you know, at all important in that regard. It's more to highlight and make transparent how this technology is being used.
Yeah. Well, I'm completely with you on we need to know. I mean, the transparency should at least be let's know what the tools are the police are using. And Ben Fox Rubin's writing about that at CNET, where he's a senior reporter. Hey, Ben, thanks for some extra time today. Fascinating stuff. We appreciate you helping us out.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you, David. This is John Williams in for Steve Bertrand. Steve's back on Monday, and I go all the way till 3. Normally 1 to 3 weekdays, but today, noon to 3, tomorrow as well. By the way, we just recorded The Mincing Rascals, judged by the Chicago Headliners Club to be the best podcast in the city of Chicago. Thanks to people like Eric Zorn and Scott Stantis at the Tribune, our Steve Bertrand and Patty Vasquez and Justin Kaufman, too. So we just dropped a new podcast. We spent some time in Trump land kicking that around. We talked about the mayoral race. We talked about the marijuana business coming to Chicago and Illinois. And we had some fun recommendations as well. The latest edition of the Mincing Rascals podcast will drop around 5. We're still assembling that. The pieces are in place. Let's talk a little bit right now on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Larry Chester. He's the president and founder of something called CFO Simplified. CFO is Chief Financial Officer, right, Larry?
That's exactly correct.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, John. Good to be here.
So you are the CFO of CFO Simplified.
Yes, I guess I do
that
too.
Yes. You were previously a CFO where?
Yes. Well, I was a corporate CFO for 25 years. I worked for Republic Windows and Doors. I worked for a High Sierra Sport Company. I worked for United Service Companies and also for Clovis Company for a while.
What do you do now?
Now I run my company. So mostly the work that I'm involved in is business development. And I also help counsel the CEOs, the owners of some of the businesses that we work for.
Who are your target clients then?
So our target clients are companies anywhere from about $5 million a year in sales to about $50 million a year in sales.
That established. I thought maybe they would be startups, ones who maybe don't even have enough growth or staff to need or have a CFO.
Well, I think the key is that a lot of businesses delay on hiring a CFO because the owner doesn't want to spend the money to do it. But I think every business needs the kind of senior financial advice that my staff gives them.
What does a chief financial officer do?
Well, we're dealing with the accounting and finance of a business from a strategic perspective. So unlike a controller who's working with like payables and receivables and payroll, we're dealing with things like cash flow forecasting, working with the bank, inventory management, dealing with cash flow, as I indicated, and strategic financial planning for the business.
Give me an example of a company you are working with or sort of a typical client's relationship with you.
Well, we have a medical practice, for instance, that's a client of ours. And they're good sized. They have outpatient surgical practice. And I have a CFO in there 2 days a week. So one of the things that she does for them is work on their cash flow planning, work on expansion, work on control of their expenses to make sure that they stay profitable, and then provide a trend analysis and financial reporting for the owner on a monthly basis and on a weekly basis so that he knows what he can expect as we plan down the road.
I told you off the air, a friend of mine is in a similar capacity, but it's as a sales manager for maybe smaller firms that have salespeople but don't have somebody to manage them as a sales team. Mm-hmm. Is this kind of a trend, sort of outsourcing managerial positions?
Well, I think the key is that a lot of businesses now, especially in the mid-market, don't need somebody on a full-time basis to run that aspect of the operation, but they still need the expertise to give the owner and the business guidance moving forward.
Are CFOs plug and play, or do you need somebody who has a medical background to manage a medical practice?
Well, you know, it's interesting you say plug and play. I think the issue is that business is business, and somebody who is a skilled CFO understands control of cash, understands banking relationships, understands profitability, understands control of inventory and payroll expenses, understands strategic planning and investment, understands all of those things. And whether you're working with a smaller company, even a startup, or whether you're working with a company that's been well established, the medical practice, for instance, that I was talking about has been around for 15 years. We have a manufacturer that we're working with that's a regular client of ours that has been in business for 35 years. And we've been working with him for a little over 3 years.
I don't know what CEO or owner and CFO relationships are like, but I wonder if a new set of eyes, maybe doing forecasting, comes in and sometimes has to present some hard truths to the owner or the CEO that maybe they don't want to hear.
Oh, I think that's very much true. I think a lot of business owners are running their businesses the way they've always run them. I'm in this lane. I'm comfortable with the way it's going, and I don't see any reason to change it. And my take on it and the take of my staff is that business, the market is changing all the time. Your competition is getting sharper. Your suppliers are getting tighter with what they're going to sell you. And your customers want to pay less and get better service. So as that business continues to change and things become more competitive, if you're looking at it the same way now that you looked at it 15 years ago, I'm afraid business is moving past you. And so we provide that fresh look of looking at things. And with new clients, we do what we call a deep dive analysis, where we come in and spend 2 days really tearing apart the company, not just financially, but from an operations perspective, and give the owner a report that really lays out what we call the good, the bad, and the ugly. You know, the things that they're doing right, the things that they're not doing right that we should probably change, and the things that, oh my God, I can't believe you're operating your company this way. We need to make some changes.
And then it's up to them to follow your advice or not.
Absolutely. And 95% of the time what they do is they come to us right after that and say, okay, you've laid out this plan of attack for us to put us on the right path. Why don't you do it? Well, that's obviously our interest, is in not only putting together the plan for them, but really putting it together and making it, you know, work within their organization.
Are you compensated based on performance, or is it just an hourly thing? How does that work?
No, it's an hourly fee. I think that the issue is whether a company is large or small, the services that we provide for them are the same as an accountant or a lawyer would provide for them. And a lot of times the success of a particular company is dependent on the willingness of the staff and the owner to follow and continue to follow the advice that we give them. If they don't follow the advice, there's not much I can guarantee.
And probably be easier to sort of coordinate that or capture that if you're on the premises, right?
Absolutely. We develop a very close relationship with the owner of a business. So when my staff is working at a company, they're on site next in an office, usually next door to the president of the company, so that he has flexibility and freedom to be able to walk down the hall and say, you know, Don, I was thinking about this. Is this a good idea or a bad idea?
Yeah. I know a little bit about working remotely, and you just lose so much. And sometimes it's inevitable. But you gain so much when you are bumping into people in the halls with a cup of coffee in your hands.
Well, and I think one of the advantages of the relationship that we have with our clients on a long-term basis is that you get to know not only the way the company is operating today, but you get to understand the owner, what his long-term goals are, what his driver is. I mean, if he's just looking at buying a new boat and buying a new home in, you know, someplace in Florida, that's one thing. But if he's looking at growing his business and passing it on to his kids, I mean, that's a totally different story. And I think the way you run the financials of a company is significantly different depending on what the goals of the individual owner are, and you can't do that if you're not standing there next to him learning who he is.
Need a CFO? CFO Simplified is the company. It's Chicago-based. Larry Chester. Been doing it for a dozen years?
Been doing it for 12 years.
Founder and president is here. How do folks reach you then?
Well, they can reach us either through our website or they can call me at 224-436-1600.
funny. I have it on a card, on a sticky pad, and on a clip-it for my air conditioning mount in my car here. So if anybody wants to know, I've been inundated with ways to pass that information along. Really interesting stuff, Larry. Congrats, and thanks for visiting with us.
Thanks very much, John. I've enjoyed the visit.
Me too. 1245. This is WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Have you gotten on the Chicago food hall train? Because it's a rollin'. Just how many food halls are in Chicago, you ask? Well, there's Forum 55, Revival, Chicago French Market, Astor Hall, Wells Street Market, Politan Row, Latinicity, and now another one coming to the old FW Woolworth flagship store on Washington Street. One of the big reasons why these models are so popular is because from a business perspective, it's not as big of a risk to open an entire new restaurant, which is expensive. And from a customer perspective, so many options. Public spaces are important factors too right now. I mean, just look at how many co-working spaces are around the world right now. Spaces big and little. And right now, you can buy a building that has a lot of space. Right down in the loop, it's called the Burnham Building, where Grubhub is headquartered, for just over $100 million. You might be telling yourself, it's just a building. But these big sales are always good indicators about where the commercial real estate stands right now. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thank you all. NCAA brackets, just a quick update here now. With 10 minutes left, the 10 seed Minnesota 61, Louisville 43. The 10 seed in Minnesota is beating the 7 seed, and the margin on that is 18 points. Yale is still losing to LSU 31-48. They're just back into the second half now. And the New Mexico State-Auburn game, New Mexico State is the 12 seed, tied with Auburn, 19 apiece, halfway through the first half. Next game that tips off at 1 o'clock is Vermont-Florida State, then Michigan State and Bradley. Amy Guth is a host here at WGN Radio. She and I share the studio on Saturdays when she does a Wintrust Business Lunch for you then. She's also now the host of Crane's Daily Gist. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Hi. How's it going?
What's the deal on this?
Well, so I every single day put together a podcast with top business headlines, most of which are coming out of the Crane Chicago Business Newsroom. And the first half of the podcast that is a daily podcast, the first half is just kind of summaries of business headlines, just kind of keep you on top of things for the day. People are busy. They want to just kind of just give me the gist, let me know what's going on. And then the second half of the show is a more in-depth conversation, usually with a Crane's reporter or somebody in the business sector doing something really interesting.
When did this start?
We're in week three now. It's still fairly new. It's off to a great start. It's really fun. It's nice that I put it together here at WGN Radio, so that's fun. I get to hang out with the fam here every day while working with the Crane's Newsroom, too.
You don't have a set time then, right? It's a podcast. What are you shooting for?
Well, we push it out every single afternoon, so we want to make sure people have it in plenty of time to get ready for their commute and all that kind of stuff, so they have something to listen to on the way home. Kind of hear the things that you missed while you were work today.
You know, we just did the Mincing Rascals today, and I struggle with how long I should go. And the people that pay a lot of attention to podcasts tell me it doesn't matter how long it is. Just go as long as it needs to be. It's the beauty of podcasts. But I've heard some that I thought went long, and I've heard some that I thought could go longer. Is there a sweet spot for you think in that?
I think for this, we're really aiming at about 10 minutes, because it's just like the name says, the gist. We really just kind of want to keep you up to date, let you hear from someone who's writing the news and who's doing in-depth reporting on a given topic. And a lot of times, a story that is in the headline summary for one day, the following day, I'll maybe talk to that reporter and get kind of a deeper dive on it, based sometimes on feedback on social media, things like that. People go, I have this question. What's the deal with this story? So I'll get the reporter on and we'll talk about it.
Did you record today's already?
I did.
Give me an example.
I pretty much am done by noon every day. Sometimes that changes a little bit, just because breaking news will happen and I'll have to go, hold on, I got to add a story.
That's what, we do a weekly podcast, the Mincing Rascals, and we begin it with the date and the time, because by the time you listen to the podcast, even if it's later that afternoon, we feel like if you think we didn't know, it's because we recorded it 3 hours ago, and Lord, the world has changed since then.
Right. That
you
came
run
up
into that every day.
Every day. That came up especially when the Sterling Bay's Lincoln Yards project hit the city council approval. So that morning we said it's expected to, we're expected to hear from city council today. We don't know. And then we did, pretty much as soon as that podcast was coming out. So
what were some headlines you looked at today?
So today I talked with the political reporter Greg Hines from Crane's Chicago Business. And we talked about the latest in the U of I South Loop research center funding. Pritzker is taking a little bit different approach to it than Rauner did. And Mayor Emanuel has been very gung-ho about this project from the beginning. So that's kind of an interesting political and academic intersection there, along with business, too. So we talked about that. And then we looked at how Notre Dame University admits to having a bigger percentage of legacy enrollments than even Harvard and Yale. They're at 11 and 14% respectively. Here comes Notre Dame with 22% legacy enrollment, meaning your parents went there and you know, so
is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, you know, I think in the moment that we're in with the college admissions scandal and things like that, it's neither good nor bad, but it is important to know how does legacy weigh in on your admissions? How does that factor in?
I'm surprised it's that high, or that they would not think that it wasn't good, right? That you'd like to think every kid, regardless of their parents, gets in based on their merit, not on the fact that mom and dad were there. Now, maybe they should. I haven't thought about this that much, Amy, but I would think that schools would run away from that rather than embrace it or even be agnostic about it.
Yeah, no? And it's not really a standardized set of data across schools, so they're called different things at different schools. Some say, oh, it's favorable, but it's just one data point in the whole admissions.
It's not an automatic.
Right. Yeah. You know, I know plenty of Notre Dame alumni, and there's like a deep, abiding love for that school, and so I think that's got to be part of it, I'm sure.
And they really want their kid to get in, and maybe that works, but then to how much favor do you, it's maybe almost impossible to quantify that, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, then there are some kids who don't want to go to the school their parents went to, and that breaks their heart.
Oh, absolutely. Like breaking that news to your parents, that's a whole other thing, right? So we look at stories like that, and then we look at kind of the latest in real estate, what's going on. You know, I spoke to Dennis Rodkin, who's a regular on this station for sure. He's the residential real estate reporter over at Crain's. And we had a conversation about a Twitter feature that he does. He takes a look at data of what houses are selling for. And he kind of does this home sold for less than, and he kind of looks at that. And he's finding really remarkable homes that are selling for way less than they did a number of years ago, even a number of sales ago. So that's a daily Twitter feature of his. So we kind of took a look at that this week too. So we do all kinds of things, just whatever the news, the business news headlines are.
Search Crain's Daily Gist. Crain's Daily Gist. Make sure you get Crain's in there, Daily Gist. It's a brand new podcast, a few weeks old, hosted by our own Amy Guth. Good luck, Amy. Well done.
Thanks so much.